Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
From the Race Across America Mobile Studios in Annapolis, Maryland, I'm George Thomas. You're listening to Ram Radio, and we're on the line with third-place Race Across the West finisher Chris Ramsey. Chris, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you're on quite the trek, heading home?
Yeah, driving home from Durango, left yesterday. I'll get home tomorrow. I'm kind of taking my time a little bit and enjoying the solitude on the way home.
I was going to say, that's probably very smart to have an easy drive.
Yeah, it's good thinking time, kind of process a little bit of what happened and the kind of next steps going forward from here.
And that's what we want to talk with you about today. First of all, I don't want you to become Chris Ramsey, the athlete with MS, because you stand alone without that designation. But that is very special, what you're able to do with MS as a part of your life. What was it? First of all, tell us what it was like when you first got the diagnosis.
Well, I can tell you very much. It was a surprise. I was formerly a member of Team Psycho, the triathlon team based out of Boston, Massachusetts, for any number of years. Still keep in touch with a lot of the people from the team. And we were getting ready for our annual indoor time trial in early February, late January, depending on whenever it was being held. And I was gearing up for that. I was gearing up to be a solid, it's about a 25-minute effort. And I across a week, I went from being able to expecting to put out about 325 watts for that 25 minutes to I could maybe do 50 watts for a half an hour. And it felt then like I had just finished an Ironman. It was just utterly exhausting. So that acute part was a dramatic shift in my ability to do anything. That was in 2008. Across that summer, I started to recover some, and I will never forget being at the Moose Man Triathlon in the half Ironman and being somewhere in the middle of the pack, and I come across somebody, and I'm being passed by somebody, and he says, "Aren't you Chris Ramsey?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "What are you doing back here?"
Oh my God.
And that thought has kind of, you know, I won't say it's haunted me, but it's been stuck in the back of my head as things change. But eventually I was able to get back to world championships again for the Hawaii Ironman, and qualified three times in the span after I'd been diagnosed before I retired from triathlons. So to some extent, there was this balance between everything changing and nothing changing. I think the mental space in between has been the more the battleground to this point. Been some changes physically, but mostly it's been just kind of gearing my head around the idea that you just got to keep going. Life gives you challenges and you just keep going.
What was your first reaction when the doctor told you your diagnosis?
Well, when I first got diagnosed, it was with something called transverse myelitis, which is a lesion in the spinal cord. And when it was, if at worst, I would have ended up as Christopher Reeve. I would have been in a wheelchair on a respirator. It was at C2, so it was way up high in the neck. And thankfully, it was not the worst case scenario. A lot of tests got done subsequent to that. Almost all of them came back positive. MRIs, spinal taps, blood tests, you have all kinds of stuff. And as I did my own research, it became pretty apparent to me that this had a pretty high likelihood of converting to MS. Now, I'm a physical therapist, so I have some medical background to begin with, and I kind of know how to do my research in terms of where I'm getting sources from and whatnot. So I was pretty confident that sounded like I had about an 85% chance of converting to MS. So at that point, my brain was like, you need to get on these medications. This is, again, 2008. The first neurologist said, no, this is it. You've had it once. It's going to be done. And if none of those other tests were positive, it would have been a 15% chance. So that would have been easy. But my research said it was something different. I went to another neurologist, and he said, yeah, this looks like it's going to convert. You need to get on the medications. Went to a third neurologist, and she said, yeah, this looks like it's going to convert. You need to get on the medications. So I got on the medications in 2008, and to me, that's when I got MS, when I started taking the medications for MS. But multiple sclerosis means you get multiple lesions in the brain or in the spinal cord that have to be at separate times and in separate places in the brain. That's the main criteria to get to quote, earn, unquote, the diagnosis. And in 2011, I finally met the criteria for that. And that time between 2008 and 2011 was just waiting. It was expecting the hammer to fall, but it hadn't fallen. Just expecting. So when I actually got diagnosed, to some extent, it was kind of as strange as it sounds, kind of a relief. Like, at least, okay, now I can at least wrap my head around the direction I need to start thinking rather than continuing to hope that it's not going to convert. I can actually, okay, it's going to convert. It did convert. Now I can go forward and down that pathway.
And you certainly have gone forward. What was it that motivated you to get into long-distance bicycle racing?
Well, like I said, I've been a triathlete. I competed in triathlons for 22 years, somewhere in there. I'd done 18 Ironman across the years, qualified for Kona 9 times. As an age grouper, I've been eligible for my pro card at one point, and that's a regret I have, is not checking that box, but that's okay. So that was, it was kind of there, that long-term stuff. And then I had a teammate from Team Psycho. We fielded a four-man Ram team in 2007, actually the year before all this started for me. And I was asked to be the crew chief for that. And so I kind of, all of us were rookies. We all launched into that and they had an epic battle all the way across the continent. That was really kind of fun to be a part of. Ended up ultimately finishing second by, I don't know, some 5-6 hours, but after 3,000 miles, that's not a whole lot of time. So in the back of my head, it was like, yeah, I might want to do this someday, but never, ever, ever as crew. The only way I'd do something like that is as a rider. And 2 years ago, I was talking with a friend of mine, and she has a diagnosis of a different condition that is going to kill her. MS isn't necessarily going to kill you. It's very unlikely that it's going to kill you. Her condition, her organs are going to stop. And she and I would meet for a beer once in a while, and she said, you know, Chris, you don't know how much time you got. You need to start checking off your bucket list items. And I said, wow, you're right. And Ram was one of those. So I signed up with a buddy of mine who is one of my crew members for Raw this year. But I signed up for a two-man Ram team with him for 2017. And he ended up hurting his back and had to pull out. And I, in the meantime, already started fundraising for Raw, for the MS Society. And was able to change my registration from the Ram two-man Ram team to solo Raw. And I got way more scared going from two-man Ram team to solo Raw. Something about having everything on your shoulders that just makes it a lot harder.
What was your longest ride to that point?
Up until that, probably 100 and I want to say 138 miles, whatever the B2B ride is for Team Psycho's B2B ride, the brewery to brewery ride from Boston, Massachusetts to Windsor, Vermont, I think it is, some little town in Vermont.
So yes, going into the 928 mile race across the West would be a huge jump from that. How did you adjust your training, and what was the response from the people in the medical field to you undertaking this?
The people in the medical field, my neurologist thought I was crazy, but at the same time, you know, there's nothing wrong with, from an MS standpoint, with me doing it. There are certain things that bother your current symptoms, but nothing I was going to do was likely to cause my condition to worsen in a permanent way. So he just thinks I'm nuts, but that's okay. My primary care is actually the head of the Human Performance Lab at OHSU, Kieran Keel, and he was all for it. He thought that was just the greatest thing in the world.
Oh, I love it.
That's just, you know, give life challenges, take them on and go for it, have a goal.
So tell us about that first experience. What happened during that race, and why were you not able to make it to the finish?
Well, we were all rookies. There were four crew and myself. We're all rookies at this particular thing. I had some ideas, obviously, from having done four-man RAM. But we had plans. We made plans, and for whatever reason, for dealing with the heat, for example, and for whatever reason, those plans just didn't get implemented. We had communication issues in terms of just helping me break down the race, became hard. So I ended up kind of just go until you get to Durango, which is just too far, almost at any point to think of just go till you get to Durango. But when you have 700 miles left, that's too big a chunk to kind of try to swallow. Our strategy for sleeping didn't pan out. We were kind of planning on the ride 18 to 20 hours, sleep for 4 hours, and that just ended up not working at all. And then we didn't have the way we did the vehicles was just, it was just overly complex and hard to manage. So in the end, though, I kind of died a solo death out there, and somewhere along the line of the climb out of Camp Verde, I decided that I just had enough, and it was time to call it a quits.
But it was a great learning experience for you. What did you learn from that you brought into 2018? Because you had a phenomenal race this year.
Yeah, we made a few good changes. All new crew. This time, my older brother Ian was my crew chief. He has done 24-hour mountain bike racing, so he's kind of familiar with the ultra scene a little bit. The mechanic that was on board had actually been a mechanic for a, I believe it was a four-man RAM team. Might have been solo, but I think it was a four-man RAM team 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. My partner from the two-man RAM, or the registration for two-man RAM, Aaron was brought on board. And Dylan, I should say Dylan from Tri-Tech Bikes, was the mechanic. Aaron came along, and he's just one of my closest friends, and it was just great to have his support. And he's had a good background of just riding a lot. He'll ride from Vancouver, Washington to Spokane, Washington, to meet his family there and just kind of do that on his own. So he's got a good, maybe not ultra cycling from a competitive standpoint, but from a riding standpoint. And then I had a guy who's just been really helpful for me and active with me in terms of fundraising for the National MS Society, Tyler. And then Vitas was a kind of a very late addition. I think 2 weeks beforehand he joined the team. And that actually enabled us to bring on two cars, which kind of just really changed things. But he was a phenomenal, he's a character. Great pictures, great cheering. Apparently he didn't like doing laundry, but he did an awesome job doing all my laundry. It's not one of the more glamorous jobs, I'm sure.
Well, Chris, you were often up battling for the lead here, and riding extremely strong, but you needed to get more sleep, correct?
Yeah, that was another strategy change that we made from last year, was that our initial plan going in was to do 6 hours on and then go down for an hour. 6 hours on, go down for an hour, 6 hours on, go down, or excuse me, go down for a half an hour, which we figured would take about an hour with 15 minutes of kind of declothing, cleaning up, and then kitting back up again to go on the other end. So it was about an hour break was what we thought it would be. And we pushed a little bit that first 8.5 hours, and I had no idea. My crew didn't tell me where I was. I had no idea where I was. I knew I was doing fine based on, at that point, at least you kind of know where you're passing people. But when we went down for our first break in Brawley at about 8.5 hours, then you have no idea who's passing you when. So they didn't tell me at all anymore after that. So I had no idea that I was anywhere near the lead up until about mile, where was it? Maybe 400, when my wife told me, she's like, "You're doing great. You've been like going back and forth in the lead." And I'm thinking, oh, I didn't want to know that because it's just too early to know that. I know I'm a racer at heart, and I need to really dial back to make sure I didn't start racing and put myself in a big hole. And I think the other big change that we made from the previous year, just to go back to that one question, because this is important from an MS standpoint, is how to cool yourself. So we talked previously about in 2017 about using ice socks, and I got my first ice sock somewhere shortly before Flagstaff, which is a little late to get an ice sock.
In 2017?
In 2017, wow. Yeah. Yeah, so in this year we had dashboard protocols that were, if it's over 90 degrees, here's what we're doing. And as soon as we dropped down to Borrego Springs, it was 108, so it was well over 90 degrees. We immediately broke out the ice socks. I was spraying down ice water on my my Castelli sun sleeves, and I can't tell you how effective that was in terms of keeping my core temperature down. It was just really phenomenal. Between the ice socks, between the middle of my shoulder blades was always freezing across the desert the whole day, freezing. And that was a big change. And then I think the other big thing that was really helpful was that my crew had a really good ability to actually adapt and change this year, whereas we had trouble with that last year. They threw out our planned log for how we're going to log nutrition by, I think it was hour 4 into the race. They were already saying, "Nope, that's not going to work. Let's try something different." And they came up with something that was going to work with them, and it worked great. We ended up switching to go to a full hour sleep, actually, and probably almost every 3 to 5 hours rather than every 6 hours. And that was really effective as well. So yeah, I had to take a lot more sleep. And apparently that led to a lot of back and forth with some of the other riders. But that extra sleep enabled me to really stay on the gas. And when I look back at my Garmin, readout, it said that I averaged 17.8 was my average moving time, or moving speed rather, when you take out lights and all the stops and all that kind of stuff. Which I thought that was pretty good.
I would say that is pretty good.
The downside is it cost me 26 hours of sleeping time, of off the bike time. So, but I think it shows that there are two strategies, you know, to be 6 hours behind the leader, behind the winner, I should say, and 4 hours behind second place, and getting probably twice as much time off the bike as they did. Needing twice as much time off the bike that they did, that I think you can be a strong rider and need to rest more, and that's okay. You can still come through pretty fast.
So was that hard for you to stop in Brawley during that early into the race and actually go down and sleep?
No, I didn't. I don't think I actually slept. The first three times that we stopped, you just got so much stuff going through your head. You can't turn your brain off.
No.
And so I don't think I actually slept more than maybe a total of 15 minutes until the second night. But even just getting off the bike, and whether it was and that first stop at Brawley, they actually spoiled me. They gave me a hotel room there. But after the, other than that, I was in the back seat of, in the back of the van. We built out a little bed in the back of the van. So they would take all the gear out and be working on everything and getting the laundry done and everything else done while I'm, while the engine's running and I'm just sleeping in the back in the AC. And the only time that didn't work was in Siloam, where it was the air conditioner in the car couldn't keep up, on the van couldn't keep up. And it was getting hotter. I actually got out of the car and laid down outside because it was just, it was 116 when I was riding.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought it was up around 120, 118. So, yeah.
It was really hot. Yeah. So, and that was, if you, I think that again shows the, what an event can do for you. If you ever told me, Chris, you know, someday you're going to take a nap and it's going to be 110 degrees in the shade and you're going to be okay with that and you'll actually fall asleep, I would have laughed because heat and MS just don't get along. My skin would be crawling and stinging and my hands and my feet would be buzzing. And by the time I got to Siloam, which is, what is that, 340 miles in after the headwind to get there, I was everything hurt, so it didn't matter anymore. It was just a matter of, I could close my eyes for a few minutes and it was okay. Crew did what they needed to do and I got back on the bike and did what I needed to do.
What was it like for you to ride past the area where you dropped out in 2017?
Well, we actually stopped there again. So we stopped in Flagstaff because that is a convenient spot to gear up on water and other supplies for the trip through the desert, through the all the way into Colorado, for that matter, to Cortez almost. At least that's what the route book told us. So we stopped there, and there was no doubt I was going on. I had the closest I got to, well, there was never a time of like, I'm not going to finish. There was a time climbing up out of Camp Verde where I was just really, I needed a nap and I was tired, and getting started after that was, I was really daunted, I think, at that point. But never anywhere near where I was a year prior, where I wanted exactly two things. I wanted to quit and I wanted to not quit. And those are the only two things I wanted. And those are kind of opposite of each other. Can't do both of those. This year, there was no doubt I was going to keep going. So when I left there, it was kind of, it was very satisfying to pull out of there and kind of move on into new territory. And now the race was unfamiliar where I was going from there. So with a third of the race left, there was kind of a little bit of that excitement of, hey, what's coming up next? That was really a kind of a neat feeling. And that was quickly, though, stifled by that descent coming out of Flagstaff, which was the scariest descent of my entire life, coming down that 40-mile stretch down into Tuba City with big, big cross tailwind that was coming across traffic. It was just really nerve-wracking.
And that is an insanely fast descent. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I took it insanely fast. I think I was overly cautious on the descent, and most of the descents, actually. I was probably overly cautious, but that one was... the good part of that was, like, when I got to the bottom, I wasn't tired. I was stressed, but I wasn't tired. Yeah. And that's a very different sense from an MS standpoint, that stress kind of, can cause you to be tired one way, but it wasn't the body fatigue that Raw was kind of putting in me at that point.
So you're definitely a racer, and where were you feeling most competitive? Did that feeling ever go away? Were you trying to close the gap on the two guys in front of you?
I didn't really know where I was. So going up, I'd seen kind of number 126, and I still don't know that. I just remember 126. I think he was the guy who ended up fourth, but I remember going up the Yarnell grade and just blowing by him. and thinking, and that was shortly after Misha spilled the beans to me that, hey, now, so I'm like, well, I think I'm in the lead now at mile 400. And coming down there was the only time in the race where I was scared from a fatigue standpoint. Like I could really feel my eyes drooping on that downhill, and having a hard time keeping them open. They just kept wanting to close on me. And at this point in my head, I am kind of racing. But I'm also realizing that I'm scared that I'm going to crash. And so I get down to the bottom of that hill, and I tell my crew chief this, and he's like, out, get in the car right now. And we're going down right now. And I got in the car. I didn't even change because it was like, he said, let's just do a 10-minute nap. So I laid down for 10 minutes. And it felt like it was about 10 minutes. And then I got up, came out of the car, and I said, how long has that been? He's like, it's been an hour. So I clearly needed that nap. And the good news there was that was like, good, your race is done now. You're not racing anymore. So I could kind of back off of that mentality. Then it kicked back in again when another friend of mine texted me and he said, hey, you're doing great. Now go catch that guy in front of you. And that was somewhere in the night on that stretch of 160 where my follow van got its flat tire. That was our only mechanical of the whole race. But the crew changed that pretty quick, and we got going again. Took a little nap there. And then when we got to that turn off, I don't know what that, I think it's time station 11, maybe.
I think you're thinking of Kayenta. Yep. That takes you into the left Monument the Valley. There. Yep.
Yeah, going into Monument Valley. Exactly. So we came in there, and that was time wise when I was due for a nap. And I felt fantastic. I was, for whatever reason, I was ready to go. And we pulled into there. And just did a kit change, and I got a Big Mac, or not a Big Mac, an Egg McMuffin sandwich. That was delicious. At least then it was. Maybe half an hour later, not so much, but at that point it was delicious. But the other guy that I'd been kind of, I guess, going back and forth with all night was in the gas station and was down, and his crew woke him up, I think. At least this is what I hear from my crew anyway. That looked like his crew had woke him up saying, he's here, you got to get going. So they apparently pulled out right behind us as we left there. We were there for maybe 15 minutes just doing a kit change. And at that point, I felt great. And so every uphill, I knew I was climbing well. So every uphill, I pushed it. I didn't jam it, but I pushed it. And then all the downhills or where there was a good tailwind, I just recovered. So it became the switch from survivor to where can I gain time and where can I recover? And that was sort of going to my cyclocross racing ideas or skills of you look at a course and you say, where can I go? Where can I make time? Where can I save time? And I think I knew somebody pulled out behind us, but my crew would tell me. But very quickly he kind of disappeared away. And then we were just up from our nap in Mexican Hat. Oh, and that timing, we timed coming through Monument Valley. That was one of my biggest regrets last year, is not getting through Monument Valley. And we timed it right at dawn. I mean, it was right at dawn when we came through Monument Valley. It was gorgeous. The guy in the follow van driving was my former partner. We our families go backpacking, hiking and stuff. Both of our jaws were dropping, and our heads were on swivels as we're just looking around at all of Mother Nature through that area there.
Now through this last part, did you change your strategy at all? Did you think, okay, I'm just going to go ahead and push until I get to the finish, or did you maintain your 6 hours on, hour off?
No, at that point we were probably more like 3 or 4 hours, 3 to 5 hours, and an hour of sleep, so an hour and a half off. Then we got to time station 13, Montezuma Creek, I believe.
Yes.
We stopped there. It was hot again. And we stopped there, and I needed to sleep, and I slept for, again, maybe an hour or so. And when we left there, my crew chief said, so that guy we were chasing, he was there when we got there, and he left, you know, not, he was on the other side of the building, so I never saw him. But he's now 14 miles up the road. And I'm now doing the math of 14 miles. I'm doing about 18 miles an hour, so that's about 50 minutes. I need to make it 50 minutes between now and the end of the race, and that's with 95 miles left. That's a big ask. But I had a friend of mine email me, and she said she gave me advice that her dad gave her when she was going to row in the Olympics. And she was the youngest member of the team. She was a teenager, I think, 19 or so. And he told her, he said, you know, you just squeeze every bit you can out of this event. These are the kind of things that just come around once. So just leave it all out there. And at this point, it's clear to me I'm going to finish, right, in the allotted time. I'm going to finish. If I had to pull over for a 12-hour nap, I'm still going to finish. So the idea of survivor is gone. And I say, that's it. We're racing. I'm going to try. I'm going to see if I can catch this guy. And so it was the same idea. It was push hard on the climbs now. I mean, relatively speaking at this point, but push hard on the climbs and recover with the tailwinds and recover on any of the downhills that you come across. And it's just stair steps up. So there's a decent chunk of times you can really recover through there. And that twisty stuff I just find is really fun. There's a nice twisty road between time station 12 and or 13 and time station 14. And we get about 2/3 of the way through, and I'm tired now. I've been working the hardest I've worked the whole race by a long shot.
Well, that is actually a soul-sucking stretch of road. When you pass Aneth, Utah, and are heading to Cortez, it's chip seal, it's slow, and it's a steady climb, even though it may not look like it. And then it kicks up a little bit, and your speed just drops through there. So I'm impressed you rode that strong.
Yeah, well, the steep ups are where I do okay. I mean, yep. I think that's, as a Cat 2 cyclist, I'm not a shabby cyclist. And climbing and being away are probably my two strengths from a cycling standpoint. Certainly not sprinting, but climbing and kind of being on the attack. So I finally ask my crew chief, I'm like, so Ian, are we making any headway at all? Because if we're not making any headway, if I pulled back 2 miles in the last 40 miles, then it's not worth the effort. Right. I'm going to just enjoy the last bit. And he says, oh yeah, oh yeah. And that just invigorates me even more. It turns out I think he may have felt me coming or something. I don't know, but he ended up, I closed all 14 miles by the time we got to Cortez. And he had pulled over into a gas stop, or into the time station rather, and was just in the parking lot as we went by him. And I think he finished, maybe 2 hours behind me, 3 hours behind me at the end. But as I passed him, it was almost, I had to kind of keep myself motivated. Having the carrot out there is invigorating. But I said, you know what, let's just keep pushing. I still had no idea if anybody was up touchable at that point. But it seemed like it was definitely worth pushing. Just let's just leave it all out there. And I ended up covering that last time station 4:13 to the finish line. Stops included. I did change kits up at the top of the hill to look nice and presentable at the finish line. And then I had, I think, one P stop, and I changed helmets, and that was it between time station 13 and time station 15 at the end. And it was still under 6 hours, including all the breaks for those last two time stations for that last 93, 96 miles. So I just put it all out there, and got to Durango, and I was just got to the top of the climb, and they kind of took it easy. I was like, don't crash on the way down. And then riding up, that last little climb was easy. I wasn't pushing there at that point. It was just kind of soaking it in. Marco Bolo, is that right?
Bolo, yep.
Bolo, thank you. He had actually was just coming down, I think, from the awards ceremony or seeing somebody else, another team finish or something anyway. And he had come down. He was sitting a couple over from me at the press conference in Oceanside. So he rode down, turned around, came up the hill, and he's pushing me actually from behind. We're just chit chatting about the race, and it was neat to be recognized and to kind of to just have that moment was kind of special. And then I said, no, I'm going to ride the whole rest of the way. So I kind of pushed his hand away from me so I could ride it the whole rest of the way. And then my team decided, as we get to the roundabout up there, to go the wrong way. So that was the only navigational hiccup we had the entire way, was my crew at that point decided with to just move the finish line on me a little bit and play around a little bit. So, yeah, and then it was this... I mean, you know how the finish line, well, you were there. I mean, you know how the finish line is it's kind of a quiet little finish line.
Yep.
And it's a very personal moment, I think, too, of my family was there. My crew was there, and that was, and then the RAM people were there. And that's pretty much it. And, to ride across the finish line, holding my 9-year-old's hand, was a really special moment as he's running along next to me taking pictures. That was a really special moment of done.
And what a great life lesson for your 9-year-old. What do you feel he learned from your example?
Well, I have no idea what he really learned, but I have the hope that my inability, my DNF last year, even by itself probably could have stood alone and been fine, right? But I think there's a lesson to be learned that just because you fail once doesn't mean you don't go back and give it another whirl and try again, revise how you did it, new strategies, change up what didn't work, and then end up trying some other stuff and hopefully it works. But just the face of defeat once doesn't mean defeat. Period. So get back out there and try again, especially for these big things. The big things are where those things that really define who you are down in your soul.
Well, that's really a good lesson for all of us. And what are your plans for the future? And I also want to hear about your fundraising and how those of us who would like to make some donations can do so.
Yeah, I'll come back to the fundraising in a minute. The next plan is definitely not RAM for anybody who's curious. I'm content with RAW. I think my neck is exhausted, even still several days later. My triceps are exhausted. My quads are exhausted. I think that I think RAW is probably pushing it for me. And kudos to the guys who can do, or the guys and girls, I shouldn't say guys, but the men and women who can do RAW, they are truly the heart, or RAM rather, they are truly the heart people out there. But I'm content with RAW. I think that my brother was I think instrumental in that thought process of there's no reason that you can't just make this a standalone chapter, a solitary experience in your life. And not have to one up it. And I don't have a feel of a need to one up this at all. This is a phenomenal experience. Especially the night and day from a year ago to this year. Although I was thinking that a relay might be kind of fun. And I could see how that would be, not nearly as hard from a training standpoint. Or from a time away from the family standpoint, but at this point, family really is the key. So July becomes the month of Misha, my wife. I think we are probably going camping almost every weekend. This summer, we're going to try to get my son wants to ride 100 miles. Last year at age 8, he did 50 miles on his own, and he wants to get up to 100 miles this year. So we need to be doing some training for that. And then he and I are going to go climb Mount St. Helens, which he and his mom did last year, again, without me, because I was training for this. But he and I are going to do it this year. So just spend some more time with the family and just appreciate that, and probably do a lot more skiing next year, because we didn't do much of that this year either for fear of getting hurt. And then fundraising is, Yeah, fundraising is going fantastic. So my goal last year was I would have been happy with five grand. If we could have raised $5,000 for the National MS Society to fight multiple sclerosis, I was going to be ecstatic. And so when we passed $32,000 last year, that was what made last year a success in my mind. Probably the only thing that made it a success in my mind, but made it a terrific success in my mind last year. So this year I said, well, we did that well last year, so let's go 50,000 this year. And that seems like a very daunting task to me as well. But we are, as of today, I think we're now 4 or 5 days after Raw, at about 30, almost 32,000 already. And that's without several matches having come in yet. I think there's at least 10,000 in outstanding matches that just the checks haven't come in from the companies that are doing the matching or the people that are doing the matching yet. So fundraising is going terrific. However, every dollar helps. And so I, if people are so moved to try to help end this disease that affects so many people, I would be honored to have them come to my page. And maybe we can put that page in the comments section. There is currently a $2,000 match, actually, that's going on. So if you contribute $20, that becomes $40. If you contribute $100, that becomes $200, just like that. So then that matching is just so key to making these events really work. It's amazing what happens when you get matches that come in. So yeah, I would be over the moon. If we can make 50,000, I will be over the moon. I cannot imagine a more successful event all around.
Well, Chris Ramsey, it's just been phenomenal to watch you perform when I've seen you race up in the Northwest, and to see what you did here at Race Across the West this year. And I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us.
Hey, I appreciate the opportunity, George. Thank you very, very much.
From the Race Across America Mobile Studios in Annapolis, Maryland, I'm George Thomas.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.